You're listening to the winning literary show, Off the Shelf Books Talk Radio, live with host Denise Turney, author of the books Long Walk Up, Portia, Love Pour Over Me, Spiral, Love Has Many Faces, and Rosetta's Great Hope. Turn up your dial and get ready for a blast of feature author interviews, 411 on book festivals, writing conferences, and so much more. Ready? Let's go.
There is a stubbornness about me that never can bear to be frightened at the will of others. My courage always rises at every attempt to intimidate me. And that quote is from Jane Austen. You have to have courage. You just have to, must believe in yourself to fulfill whatever it is you came in this world to do. And I want to say good morning, good morning, good morning. And to our listeners who've been with us, I'm just shocked that we have been on the air. I'm telling you, it's now 18 years. I'm just stunned. We started on a real late radio show, Rainbow Soul, and then we came over to Blog Talk Radio. Who knows what the future holds? I'm just stunned that we've been this long, so many guests, people, New York Times bestselling authors, movie producers, actresses. I mean, it's just amazing the people who've been on. But if this is your first time tuning in, you're just looking for something to do on Saturday, I want to welcome you and let you know that, yes, you are listening to the Winning Book Podcast, Off the Shelf Books, and welcome to our Saturday, July 20th, 2024 show. Thank you so much for being here with us. Before we launch into today's show and introduce our wonderful guest this morning, I just want to ask you how good of a mystery sleuth are you? Yeah, are you? Can you figure it out? If you're watching a TV show or a movie, are you one of those people? You can figure out who did it before the show shows you. Or you read a book. You know, I know just who did that. I know who did it, and I know why. I know everybody involved, everything. Are you one of those people? Some people are really good at that, really good at figuring out a mystery. But if you love mysteries and you're a good mystery sleuth, I encourage you to get a copy of Love Pour Over Me so you can figure out who done it. But even more than that, this book is a book about relationships. There's a complicated father-son relationship and a true soulmate relationship in this book. If you value relationships and you love a mystery, I encourage you to get a copy of Love Pour Over Me by yours truly, Denise Turney. Ebook and paperback formats available. You can get it anywhere, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Walmart, Target, anywhere where books are sold. If you don't see it on the shelves, just ask the clerk to order you a special copy of Love Pour Over Me by Denise Turney. You can also get it at my website, www.chistell.com. And now, let us go and meet today's special off-the-shelf guest. And this morning's guest is Harrison Stokeland. And Harrison is a new American author. His debut novel is a crime thriller, and it's titled Watch It Burn. And Harrison, the new author, I'm telling you guys, he is not wasting time creating these thrillers. His second novel is already out, so he came out with Watch It Burn, new author. That was his debut. He is not wasting time. His second novel is already out, and it is titled November's Whisper. I love those titles. Check Harrison out online at officialharrisonstokeland.com, officialharrisonstokeland.com. So the last name, again, officialharrisonstokeland. Put that C and that K together. STOCKELAND.com. You can even go over to his website right now. Check Harrison Stokeland out, even as you enjoy listening to what he shares this morning on Off the Shelf. We're just honored to have Harrison here with us this morning. I hope I pick up the right line. Welcome to Off the Shelf Books, Harrison.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing fabulous. How are you doing on this Saturday morning?
Oh, I'm doing great. You know, it's 10 a.m. Central Time. It's the perfect time of morning. I got my coffee. I got my water. I'm ready to rock and roll.
Okay, sounds good. So the first few questions I'm going to ask you, I ask every guest when I started many, many moons ago, I would go right into the questions, and the guests told me they wanted to. Listeners want to learn a little bit about the guests before I go into talk about the book. So to kick it off this morning, can you tell off-the-shelf listeners where you grew up and what life was like for you growing up?
I grew up in Grand Forks, North Dakota, so you may never have heard of it. If you have, it was probably something to do with the flood of 1997. That was a big deal up there. It's been the coldest city in North America, I don't know, probably 8 out of the last 10 years. We live right in the Red River Valley, so in the wintertime from December, from like mid-December through the end of February, it's in the negatives every day and every night. So, that you know, that's negative 20 with a negative 40 wind chill, right?
Wow.
So it's real cold outside in the winter times. In the summers, it's actually pretty nice, but it's real flat, so there's lots of corn and corn, soybeans, and up in Grand Forks, it's sugar beets is the big crop. So it's a big farming community, just like the rest of North Dakota. And, yeah, I grew up there. I was born and raised in North Dakota. Life there was great. I really enjoyed growing up in the Midwest. You know, I obviously didn't know any different. I didn't know that everybody else had a much pleasanter winter. I just thought winter was just as harsh for everybody, but other than that, it was fantastic. Two great parents and a younger sister that, you know, sometimes she's my best friend, sometimes she's a bother. So, you know, it's just kind of a very classic growing up story.
Okay. Oh, your sister tickled me when you talked about your sister. I'm sure you protect her too. Most brothers look out for their sisters. So when you were a kid, what did you dream of becoming? What did you want to be when you grew up, when you were a kid?
Oh, I mean, you know, any given Tuesday, it was a different thing. I would say the two longest things. For a long time, I wanted to be in the Air Force. I wanted to be a fighter pilot. My dad was a pilot, not in the Air Force, but I always thought that was really neat. And then as I got older, I started realizing you had to be really, really smart to get into the Air Force's fighter pilot program. And I had a real conversation with myself, and I was like, you know, you're not dumb, but you're terrible at math, and that's pretty important. So we decided that we're not going to do that around age probably 13. Then I got interested in some other military stuff, like Army Rangers. I was always interested in that kind of path. I have some family members that were in the service, and so that was always interesting to me. Then towards the end of high school, I was like, you know what? I'm gonna be a U.S. Marshal. I think that would be really cool. Some federal law enforcement stuff like that. I went through a phase there. Then I got offered an internship in Washington D.C. with a trade association out there as like a lobbyist group, and I was like, that sounds really interesting. So I sort of did a big pivot, hopped into politics stuff for a few months, and headed out to Washington, D.C. But, yeah, so I was all over the place for many years.
Okay. Who or what inspired you to pursue writing? What birthed your love for books?
You know, I would say during COVID, like everybody else, I had plenty of time. I think that's going to be a very common story in the next few years with writers, with, you know, songwriters and creators all around the world. I had plenty of time. I ran out of things to do, and I've always been a reader. I've always enjoyed books. I was going through a Dan Brown phase at the time. So the early books that I wrote five before I published Watch It Burn. So the earlier books really sound like Dan Brown because that's all I was reading. So anyways, I was reading a lot during COVID, and I was like, you know what? I've got all the time in the world. I might as well try writing. And I really enjoyed it. So I wrote a whole book in, I don't know, like 2.5 or 3 months or something. Nothing else to do. And when I finished that one, I hit save on the computer, and I opened up a new Word document and started the next one, and it just never really stopped. So yeah, I've just been on a roll ever since.
Oh, my goodness. You know, some people, it's interesting. I know I put out more books during COVID too, but that came because somebody was, we were talking to a group of people and they were like, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just going to take it easy. They told me you should be writing. And that's what made, gave me the idea to do that. And I've seen people make career changes. It's almost like we're so busy. We are our lives are
yeah.
so crammed and so full. We don't have time to think. So COVID gave people time. I saw people make total career moves coming out of COVID. Total career moves.
Oh, yeah.
People who had extreme success in one career totally go into something else. It was like amazing to just watch that happen. Now, just you said it took you. I was going to ask you how long it took you to write Watch It Burn. You said 2 to 2.5 months. So you must, how many hours a day were you knocking out over those 2.5 months? And what inspired that particular story?
Well, Watch It Burn took a little bit longer. The 2.5 months was the first one I wrote during COVID, which I never published. There was a few that I wrote, full-length books. I just, you know, they're filed away. They're never going to see the light of day. It's just, you know, you got to start somewhere, right? Watch It Burn took me probably about 5 months to write, which is still a pretty quick time frame for a 320-page book or whatever it turned out to be. And, yeah, I mean, writing's my hobby, right? So that's my, you know, that's where my hobby time goes. When I'm not, you know, at my day job or doing things like that, I'm at home or at a coffee shop in front of my laptop wearing down those keys. And I would say on average I write about 2 hours a day. So I stay pretty busy. 2 hours can get me 3 or 4 pages if I'm, you know, real focused. So, yeah, I spend a lot of time just locked into the laptop and typing away. At the time I wrote Watch It Burn, I was living in Washington, D.C., and I had just moved there. So I didn't have a lot of friends. I didn't have a big social circle. So my evenings and my weekends were just, you know, all about writing.
Okay, and what inspired, I'm going to ask you to tell us more about the story later, but what inspired you to write this particular story?
There's a few different things. I've always loved kind of like the 90s gangster movies. I've always thought those are super fun to watch. You know, Martin Scorsese and those guys. And I've always enjoyed that kind of story. I've also enjoyed true crime, especially, you know, true crime revolving around the organized crime on the East Coast of the United States and, you know, from the 20s all the way until, you know, I mean, it's still going on today, but the heyday from the 20s through, like, the late 80s. And so, you know, I'd always had that interest. I think I was watching Godfather 2, and there's a really intense scene kind of towards the end where it's like, you know, all the emotions are boiling. They're starting to boil over. And Michael and his wife are having a huge argument. And, you know, and he brings something up, just a real low blow about her losing one of their children, like a stillbirth. And she just yells back at him, I had an abortion, Michael. And it's like a super, super, like, yeah, exactly. You just go, what? And like, you know, it's very, and then the whole, you know, the whole screen goes silent for a minute and they just kind of look at each other. But anyway, so I saw that scene. And if you read the book, it makes sense. There's nothing, you know, that exact situation doesn't happen. But I kind of saw that look in, I forget her name right now, but that actress's eyes. And I was like, you know what, that's going to be the basis for a really strong character. And then that's how I got Stella Costello, who is one of the side characters in Watch It Burn. But, you know, she turns out to play a pretty big role in the story. So.
Oh, you kind of go into my next question. I wanted you to introduce us to Stella Costello. What is this character like? How old are they? Where do they live? And what drives this character?
Sure. So the main character in the story, his name is Del Costello. He was an American criminal, basically. He was born and raised in South Florida. He was just the right age to go to Vietnam. There's not much in the book about his service, but you do know that he was in Vietnam. And he comes back, and him, his brother, John, and their best friend, Gerard, get together, and they decide that they want to corner the Miami cocaine market in the mid-70s. And so they go out, and this is kind of an interesting part in the story. It's only a couple paragraphs, but if you know your history and your crime history, I talk about all the different heads of the Italian and the Cuban cocaine syndicates in Florida and how they go around and basically knock them off and take over their business. So that's where it starts deviating from history, right? So that's where it breaks from what really was to what could have been. And from there, they set up their little empire in Miami. Again, this is all very brief in a couple pages it describes this. And then what happens is he starts trading his illicit drugs with the a family out of southern Italy, and he ends up meeting that family and marrying the daughter. She's the only child, and so he inherits that Italian crime family when the father passes away. And so the whole story is set in Italy. It's an American mobster in Italy instead of, you know, an Italian mobster in America. It's kind of just flipped there, they slowly start realizing that the father of the Italian crime family that has since passed away had done some pretty terrible things in his life, and there's people that are out there that are still looking for retribution and justice for those things. And so though he wasn't a part of it and his wife wasn't a part of it, they end up facing some of that. And, you know, through the story, you start realizing there's someone within the organization that is plotting against them. And it slowly turns from the classic mob war of the family story into an internal whodunit. And I think it's a lot of fun.
Wow. So what was, okay, you might have already answered this, but I'm curious. I always like to know character motivations. What was Dale doing before he decided he wanted to get into drug trafficking? Had somebody else in his family been involved in it? What was his life like? What makes a person choose their career field? What made him decide to go into drug trafficking? Did he live in a community where there were a lot of drug traffickers, and that was his examples? Why did he choose that?
I briefly mentioned some just backstory on him and his brother John. They grew up in a part of South Florida where there wasn't a lot of money. And they grew up in an area where crime was kind of what you did if you didn't go to college, you became a criminal. I think that's a line in the book. That was just the natural progression for them. And then, you know, little steps in the right direction eventually, or I guess in this case the wrong direction, little steps in the wrong direction, eventually you look back and you've walked a few miles, right? So he was facing down some pretty difficult things. And once, you know, once he got over to Italy and he's running this, you know, crime family that now we're looking at in the United States, it was at that point in the story, it was less than 60 years that organized crime had really been strong. Whereas in Italy, it was a couple hundred years. So he's running this legacy crime family now, and he's too far gone. Not that he wants to go back, but that's not even an option anymore. So the motivation just, I think, becomes repetition, if that makes sense.
You know, you made a good point. You hear people say this, and I think sometimes it's not that when we're new to something, we think it's going to all turn out so swell. Like you said, you can get into some things, even something that's not in criminal, you get high up in an organization, and it's just too much pressure to step away would be almost impossible. It would be almost impossible to step away. Is he, and then his wife must be more aware, because she's the daughter of a crime boss, right? So she must be more aware. Is he though aware of the treacherous past of his father-in-law? Is he aware of this at any point before it's too late, or is he naive? I guess that's a better question. Is he aware of what he's really going into? He's thinking it's going to be like Miami Vice TV series. He's got this right. He's naive. Is he naive? Is he aware of just how much danger he's stepping into?
He he's aware, but he willingly ignores it. I think there's some of that humanity there where it's more profitable for him both economically and personally to just ignore what had happened. And it didn't affect him. He wasn't around. Like, the book opens up, the prologue basically goes through all of that, what happened between the families and how Stella's father turned on a couple of allies in order to make strides in the market and killed a lot of people. Most of them were innocent, uninvolved. You know, there was the opening scene of the book is basically a dinner time massacre. So the Stella's father invites that family over to the house. Stella and the young girl from the other family are outside playing. While they're outside, everyone from the other family gets murdered in the dining room. And this is in the first, you know, four pages of the book. So I'm not spoiling too much for you guys. But that kind of sets the stage. So she really knows because they kill her friend in front of her. And so she really knows exactly what went on. And that really lives with her. But Del, you know, Del was in South Florida around, you know, he was 5 or 6 years old, you know, across the world, had no idea. So he doesn't have that exposure to it. They didn't follow through all the way because they wanted to be cruel and they wanted to leave a survivor. And that caused problems in the future. So,
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Before I go on, I have a more question to ask you about this before we go into November's Whisper. Did you, when you first sat down to write this, or even when it say you got the last word written, do you see this as a movie?
Oh, absolutely. That's one thing about my writing. I'm very visual, and I'm probably one of the few authors you would meet that would tell you I love movies more than I like books. And I think that'll always be the case. I'm a big reader. I love reading, don't get me wrong, but there's nothing quite like Shawshank Redemption or The Godfather or The Departed or Shutter Island, things like that. It's just not, to me, the film is amazing. So I'm very visual. My writing's very visual. So it's really easy to picture what is going on, where it's happening, how it's happening. I'm not very prosy, so I don't spend a lot of time trying to sound fancy. I don't slack off either. Like, it's easy to read. I want it to be easy to read, but it's very, you know, I try to stay away from a lot of the sound alikes and things like that, and just keep it visual. And yeah, like you said, you hit it spot on. I definitely saw it as a movie. The whole thing, scene by scene, if I made it a movie, it would look exactly how it looks in the book. Because I did, you know, did start out as that visualization.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing. I've had people read and they're like, oh, I can see this as a movie. Or I can literally see the scene, see it.
Yeah, that's a huge compliment.
And I think that's a good trait to have as a writer.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little, this Ventini family, how long have they been in operation? And why are they trying to dethrone Dell?
The Ventini family has been around just as long as Stella's family, the family that's now the Costello family. It's been a couple hundred years. Like, I think there's a line in the book where they mention, like, we don't even remember, you know, who started this, but, it, you know, it's been around. It's been our thing for many years. And they're making moves because, it's classic older father figure in his mid-80s, and then young son in his late 20s who is overly ambitious, thinks he understands more than he does, and is very aggressive. The Ventinis, their operation is gambling, so they run gambling and prostitution in mid-southern Italy, and they have a lot of manpower. You know, in terms of if you're looking at this in the sense of a war, they have a lot of troops and soldiers, soldados, as they call them in the book. And they're a more violent family. They're more feared. Their image is a little stronger. Like, they're less covert. The Costello family operates very covertly because the drugs they're moving is, you know, it's harmful to people. So they're more wanted by police. The police are more willing to ignore, you know, the gambling and the prostitution. And so the Ventini family is just a more aggressive family, I guess. You could look at it like that. And what happens is Antonio Ventini, Tony Ventini, the son, he assaults John's wife at his father's birthday because his father throws his grand birthday party. He assaults John's wife in an overtly sexual path that, you know, as you could imagine, would piss off a husband, make him very upset. And, you know, these are gangsters, right? So you never know who's going to whip out a gun or who's going to start throwing punches or stab somebody. And so there's some tension for a couple chapters. And then the way John gets back at Tony, since Tony has a huge ego, when they all get up on the stage to wish Tony Sr. a happy birthday, John just walks right past Tony, doesn't shake his hand, just kind of bumps past him. And that really embarrassed him. And then Tony got very, very mad and decided he was going to retaliate against the Costellos. And that kind of just started this snowball of small actions that turned to bigger actions. And then all of a sudden there's a war. So.
Wow. Yeah, it does start one small thing. Your story sounds very, very interesting. Does Dale have a crew around him? And can the people who are around him, can he really, really trust these people?
Sure, yeah. Of course he has a crew. Of course he's got an organization. They're very they run a very lean organization. So they have the movers and the shakers at the lower levels locally, and then they have themselves, and they try to keep it pretty clean. They clean their money in the United States, in Florida, with the Jewish syndicate over there. But other than that, they keep a pretty lean organization, not like the Ventinis, who have just guys all over the place. So it's a little bit of a different dynamic. Yes, he starts out, you know, ready for war, and he's trusting everybody that's been surrounding him for years at this point. I mean, he's been in Italy for, I think, 15 years at the time of the story. So people that have been around him for over a decade, and then he starts realizing that that's not the case anymore, and he's going to have to take things into his own hands. And by the end of the book, he's the last person that he trusts, and it puts him in a very scary.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah.
Oh my gosh! He sounds like he's coming in like naive again, like okay, this is going. All I got to do is do ba 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 ba, and this is all going to just smoothly. Oh, my goodness, this story sounds interesting. Then he's coming in, and it's not the way he thinks, but he can't turn back. It's too late now. You're in it now. You can't turn back.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Very interesting. Introduce us to personalities. Please describe Dale, what he's like. Is he very aggressive, mean? What kind of guy is he, and some of the other characters in the story, if you could introduce our listeners to them?
I made Dell fair, young, wise, and but impressionable. He, like I said, he's from the United States, where organized crime has been around for less than 60 years at the time of the story. And he's, so you could think of him as a small fish swimming in the ocean with the sharks. There's people there that know the history, know how these things work, and understand relationships, understand revenge. They understand all these, you know, subtextual interactions that happen more than he does, even though he's a smart, competent guy. He's tough, but he's fair. I made him about as moral as you could make a cocaine distributor, if that makes sense, right? So he's you like him. He's a cool guy. His brother John is a little cooler and a little kinder. But Dell is a very, very solid guy. He's somebody you'd want on your team, if that makes sense.
Okay. Are there plans to turn this into a book series?
Oh, no, not Watch It Burn. If you finish it, you'll understand why. There's not a lot left at the end to roll over into other books. So Watch It Burn will be its own thing. November's Whisper, however, is getting a sequel at the end of this year. So I can talk a little bit about that if you want. But, yeah, that one's going
to
roll
into
a sequel.
Yeah, we're going to go into it. I just had another question on Watch It Burn, which sounds very interesting. Because it's not just the plot, it's the characters. That's what keeps people turning when they get attached to a character. What have readers been saying about Watch It Burn?
I mean, they enjoy it. I've not really gotten any negative notes or comments on it. I think it was a shock to people who know me personally reading that book. And, because I'm a pretty happy social person. So then when I'm writing a book with a lot of violence and a lot of language and harsh, just a harsh theme to it, people are kind of surprised. So I think that was kind of funny to see. But lots of support, people really enjoying it. And I could tell by the way November's Whisper was received that people had actually enjoyed Watch It Burn, as opposed to just like, oh, yeah, it's great. Like, oh, we love it. Sure. They went out of their way to find November's Whisper immediately when it was available. And that tells me that Watch It Burn was a success as a debut novel.
Okay. Now, so you said you sat down as soon as you finished writing Watch It Burn, you sat down right away and started on November's Whisper. Is that correct? You mean like the day after you just started into your next novel?
Yeah, I'd say I probably gave it a day. So, yeah, the next day I just opened up my computer, because I already have the story fully baked in my mind. I just got to purge it out onto the Word document. I just sat down and started writing. November's Whisper was a little bit of a different process for me. The story that was in my first draft versus the story that was in the final draft is pretty different. I changed a lot, which I don't usually do. Usually I have it fully committed, and I just finish it off. But I changed some perspective things, and I also changed out of the three characters you see throughout the whole book, I changed who the main character was, and it was a great choice, and it set me up really well for a series, which is going to happen now. It's really neat. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
Introduce us to Henry Hayes. What drives him? I always want to know about the character, their personality, what they're like, their background.
Of course.
Could you introduce us to Henry?
Yeah, Henry. Henry's a lot of fun to write. So I modeled him after some real-life people that I learned about studying this subject. I did a ton of research for November's Whisper. I did several interviews with law enforcement personnel, active, retired. I did lots of book research. I got lots of experience and knowledge from former, district and assistant district attorneys. So I spent a lot of time researching throughout this process just to make this as genuine of a story as I could. And through that I was able to develop Henry Hayes. He kind of became a mush of real people, people I made up, people I met. He kind of became a combination of all those folks with a little bit of that Midwest hometown. He's from Oklahoma, so he is he's not from Chicago. He's not from New York. He's from that smaller corner, or I guess center of the United States, which makes him relatable to me. He's a solid moral guy. He wants to do the right thing. He's confident in his work. He's a little bit too confident in his work, I think. He's very smart, and he understands that. But he's not, he's not braggadocious. He's not obnoxious about it, but he's very certain that the way he's doing things is the correct way. And there are some faults there, and it causes some problems. But I think he's about as far from a complex character as you could get. He's a very straightforward, easy to know, easy to like guy. And that's the point with him, because I am using him as the lens into these different crimes for this series. So by making him easy to like, easy to know, and easy to understand, I make it easy for you to jump from book to book and spend a lot of time interested in the other detectives and the other characters in the books. Well, Henry's still around, and he's still the main character, but you don't have to worry about trying to figure him out because you already know what he's like. He's got his complications, and he's he's got his little quirks, but he's not a mystery to you, which frees you up to enjoy the detectives and the criminals in these stories that are only going to be there for the one book, right? And I think that's a lot of fun.
Okay. What's going on in the town of, hope I pronounce it right, Ipswich, Massachusetts, at the start of November's Whisper?
Ipswich, Massachusetts. Yeah, first of all, I'd love to say, if you ever get the chance, if you're in Boston and you've got some time to kill, take the 20-minute train ride up to Ipswich. It's a real place. It's very, very nice. I love it there. Like, I would vacation there, but they don't really have the infrastructure for that. They have, like, one small little hotel. But it's a very nice small town. I think it, you know, really encapsulates small-town Massachusetts. Small town Northeast. It's beautiful. So that kind of set the stage. There's 2,000 and some people, 8,000 and some people in Ipswich at the time of this this writing when the book was set in the early 80s, and so they have a very small local police force. Not much goes on there. There's not a lot of crime. It's a pretty safe place. It's a middle-class town. Pretty much everybody who lives there either works up in southern New Hampshire or works down in Boston. And it's just a calm, easy place to live. A lot of the people that have lived there for a long time. It hasn't really changed a lot in the decades and the centuries it's been around. And so Kelly Dunn is the local detective there, and he spends his days investigating really boring crimes. I mean, I think at one point he mentions you can't even call half of them crimes, like it's a kid keying a car or, you know, stuff like that. And then a homicide shows up in his town, and it's pretty brutal. A young lady who lives alone was strangled and beaten after she was dead, among other, gruesome things they won't mention on the radio, but, she endured some serious trauma before she was killed. And, this is nothing like anyone in that town has seen, except for a similar crime that happened a few years prior, before Kelly's time as a detective.
I was
going to
ask
so,
you next. In what ways do the events at the start of November's Whisper link to what happened in the town 4 years earlier? But if that'll give the story away, then don't answer that question.
Through a roundabout process, the state police catch wind of this case, and they're able to link it to a case they had that was just across the small Plum Island Sound, which is like this little bay in a state park. And they're able to link those two cases, so the state police get involved with Kelly, who's the local police, and the district attorney for that area. In Massachusetts back then, they were one of the first states to actualize investigations to the district attorney's office, which basically means the district attorney and his office runs the investigation so far as, like, who's involved. If we're going to ask for help, if we're going to do these things. So the district attorney decides that they need the FBI to help them out. And so the FBI sends Henry Hayes, and he begins working on a profile to help them find this killer.
Who is Miss Kelly Dunn? You just introduced a few little things about her, but what role does she play in November's Whisper?
Well, first of all, Kelly is a guy, so he's got kind of a funny guy's name. Yeah, he's Irish, so it's relatively common up there. But yes, Kelly's a guy. He's got his own. You kind of really dive into his personal life. His marriage is a mess. He's married to kind of a crazy lady who's really neurotic and borderline sociopathic. She's kind of just a little bit insane, and you start realizing she always has been. So he's dealing with that at home, and then he's also dealing with this big crime, something like he's never investigated before, and he's trying to handle that and act like he has it down, even though he may not. And so that becomes sort of his struggle, is trying to prove that he should be involved in this and that he has something to contribute. He's a great interviewer. He's great at linking up evidence. He's just never done something like this before. So, and then Melissa Tooney is the state police detective that they send up from Salem to help out. And I wanted to keep this book real close-knit. I wanted a quarter group. I wanted Henry. I wanted Kelly. And I wanted Tooney. And to do that, you know, because in real-life circumstance, a murder like this, they'd send 7 or 8 state police detectives up there, and they would all be, you know, swarming all over the town trying to figure this thing out. So to keep this small, I created a event in Boston where there was a shooting at the North Station in Boston, right near TD Garden. That was a big deal. So the state police and a lot of FBI, local FBI resources are all investigating that, looking for the shooter. So they don't have a lot of people to spare, so they send Melissa. And that's how I was able to keep it kind of a small core group of characters with crimes that close to a major city. Because in a real-world scenario, there would be I don't know, a dozen or so investigators up there looking into that. So.
Is this the first time Kelly and Melissa have worked together, or have they worked together before?
They bumped into each other during that first murder 4 years before the main story starts, but they didn't work together on that. That Kelly was the first one to respond to that because he was local, first investigator to respond because he was local, but state police had jurisdiction over it, and they kind of kicked the locals out. So they had met. But they didn't. They didn't know each other very well.
So So Henry's going to make an appearance throughout each book in the series. Will we see Kelly and Melissa again, or are they only going to make an appearance in November's Whisper?
No, they'll only be in November's Whisper. I'm taking Henry all over the country. So in the next book, he'll be up in Minnesota, small town Minnesota, kind of right near where I grew up. So. Taking him all over the country, and he's going to meet all sorts of new and interesting folks, both investigators and criminals. So it'll be very, very interesting for him. He's got a lot in store for him in the next couple of years.
Oh, you know, that's so interesting that you are, when you created this series, mm-hmm. was that always your initial intent? You're only going to have one character show up in every book, which is kind of genius. If somebody, you got to really like Henry, first of all. The readers have really got to be engaged with Henry because he's going to be the character that's like this super glue, keep you stuck to the story. But then also you have to buy every book because these characters, you're not going to see these characters in 3, 4, 5. So Henry's got to be like the main thing. But
yeah,
because Kelly and Melissa sound very interesting. So you'd have to buy every book in the series just to meet these different characters, and also wanted to ask you for each. It sounds like since Henry's traveling, each story is going to be a whole different scenario going on with each.
Oh yeah,
story.
Absolutely. Different type of crime, different location, different investigators, different circumstances, and to me that really reflects the real life world of an FBI profiler, which is what Henry is. They travel, 320 days out of the year, going to small towns,
wow.
Going to big towns. Yeah, like they're very busy, and I think that writing a series like that where he, you know, because again, if I was to keep it 100% realistic, the profilers have regions that they work in. So you know, if he was in the Northeast, he'd stay in the Northeast. He was in the Southeast, he'd stay in the Southeast, Midwest, you know. But I want to take him all over the country, and I think that gives you, even though it's not totally accurate to how they run things, it gives you a very, very realistic glimpse into what their lives were like in the early days of profiling, where they're just, you know, a flight from, you know, Quantico to Louisiana, Louisiana to Minnesota, Minnesota over to Illinois, Illinois back over to Arizona, like just insane. Always traveling, you know, one suitcase full of clothes, you're washing it, you know, in the middle of the night at a laundromat, like, you know. So I think that travel really brings a unique perspective. And then I get to, you know, I get to write a series, which I never thought I would do, but I get to write a series, and I get to have new and interesting characters that are meaningful in each book, without compromising the overall story.
So you did a lot of research. You interviewed different people, and I could tell from listening to you, you did who work in like the criminal investigation, et cetera, law enforcement, criminal justice. Was there anything you learned, whether it was who does the profilers, detectives, et cetera, that really shocked you, even after all your other book research or TV shows you've watched, when you spoke to them individually, was there anything you learned that really blew you away?
I don't know, anything specifically that isn't, you know, personal, because I'm talking to these people one-on-one. So there's some personal stuff that I wouldn't share that I learned that was pretty shocking. But I think, you know, just as a generic sense, I think it was how dedicated these people actually are in real life. Like, you'll watch a movie like Prisoners. Prisoners is a great depiction of detective work, in my opinion, as a layperson. But Prisoners depicts a detective played by Jake Gyllenhaal, and he's just committed. Like, there's these missing little girls, and he's committed to finding them. And that commitment really, with the people I talked to, was a real thing. Like, they just get locked in, and it becomes, you know, tunnel vision on whatever they're working on. And that made, I mean, that first of all, it made me feel real safe knowing that those people are actually out there, and they're committed to their work, and they're committed to justice and those kind of things. And second, I just found it very interesting that that's not cinematic, that's real life. Like, they are just so committed. And again, this is people I talk to. I'm sure there's detectives out there that don't, you know, they don't do their jobs and they're terrible detectives. But the people I talked to were so committed to the victims, to the families, that it was just really interesting to see. And of course, as an author, I take that and I go, okay, well, how can you take this too far, right, and cause problems with that? And so I play with that a little bit in the different books. But yeah, I think the commitment on, like, a writ large between all these guys was just, like, it blew me away. I didn't understand how it's not just a job for them, it's their lives. And I think that was really huge.
Yeah, I've watched some crime documentaries where a detective will start crying at some part of it.
Oh, yeah.
Some cases shake them so much that they retire after the case. Or they'll say that case still haunts me. We were never able to solve it. Or it was so horrible that even if they did solve it, they're like, it's still with me. I can't, it's hard to get over it. Yeah, that's something you would, because you, when I think of a detective, and it's curious about Henry, he's a profiler, but they seem like these people who don't have a lot of emotion. They just do things and it doesn't really affect them. They in TV shows show people dealing with crime, eating a sandwich, standing over a dead body, like, who can do that? You know, so that's the way Henry as a profiler, let me ask you, does he actually go on the crime scene or no? The detectives just tell them what happened?
Yeah, so, I mean, in real life, there's different ways it plays out. It's just unique to the situation. In the book, what happens, and this is a realistic depiction of how it could have gone back then, but he is called out. He arrives. This is about a week after the crime is committed, and they just don't really have any tangible leads. And when he arrives, he, like, lets them know. And he's like, I'm not here to solve your case. I'm not here to take over your case, because that was kind of the general – that was the general consensus of, like, what the FBI would do if you called them for help. They'd be like, oh, we'll help you, but we'll take it all. And they didn't want that. So he was like, well, I'm not here to do that. I'm here to support. So the name of the unit is the Investigative Support Unit. And so he'd be like, we're true to our name. We're here to support investigations. And we do that through giving you a lens from which to view both the victims and the perpetrator. Understanding the victims in some of these cases is just as important as understanding the person who committed the crimes, because for some reason or another, the victim and the perpetrator are connected, and you have to figure out what that is. That may not even be a personal connection. Like, the victim could be a prostitute and the perpetrator could be a mill worker, right? It, but they're connected somehow, and that connection could be something as little as she works on the road that he drives to work on every day. Like, there's things like that. There's a connection, whether, you know, and the old school of thought of investigative work, you know, pre-1975 was, well, you know, everything has an interpersonal motive, right, or it's financial motive. So, like, if you, you know, if this young kid robs an old lady and steals $100 and kills her, there's obviously a financial motive there. If you kill your ex-wife because you hate her, there's a personal motive there, right? But they were running into these bizarre crimes that didn't really make sense. They didn't have personal or financial motives. And what the investigative support unit basically came up with after studying these offenders that were eventually caught was that there was this underlying subtextual sexual motivation for these crimes. And it doesn't make sense to normal people, or what we would call normal people, but there's a sexual element to these crimes, even if it's someone like David Berkowitz, who's just shooting people in cars. Like, that was a sexual crime for him. And that doesn't make sense, right? It's kind of weird. So they figured this stuff out, and that's how they look through these lenses. Now, not all the crimes they visit are like that, but that was the new school of thought, and that's what Henry brings to these old school investigators, if that makes sense.
Interesting. Oh, my goodness. You're when you talk about your books, and I hope you go on a lot of radio interviews, you're very good at talking about your books and then your research. It makes people that much more interested in reading the story. So I wanted to ask you, I love that title, November's Whisper. Is there a particular inspiration behind the book's title, November's Whisper?
Well, it takes place in November. The whole book takes place in November, except for the epilogue, which I think is like the next March or something. So November in Massachusetts is a very notable season, right? You're transitioning from fall into winter. It's raining every day. There's dead leaves on the ground. I can just smell it just thinking about it, right? That's where the November piece came from. It's very heavy on the November theme. And then the actual term November's Whisper is, I think that's the last two words in the epilogue. So you'll have to read the book to figure out exactly what that means, but it does have a meaning. And it's a little bit chilling. So you'll have to read the book to figure out exactly what that meaning is. But yes, there is inspiration for that title.
Okay. Now, so as we come down to the last few minutes in today's show, can you tell us what writing process do you follow? You said you just sat down during COVID, you knocked out all these stories, some you'll never publish, but you did publish November's Whisper and also Watch It Burn. So I wanted to ask you, it took you about 4 to 5 months to write Watch It Burn. How long for November's Whisper? And do you do character sketches, outlines? How do you sit down and just start creating a story?
Yeah. I mean, I don't really write much down. I don't do character sketches or outlines, really. I keep most of it in my head. I'll write down, like, on my whiteboard, I'll write down, like, you know, names if they have a weird spelling, or like the ages of people. I often forget like the age of somebody. So one day, you know, Henry's 30, the other day he's 34. Like, you know, I'll do stuff like that where I forget. But no, mostly I just keep it all in my head and just pound it out. Like I said, by the time I get around to the story, it's already, you know, pretty much ready to go. Usually just a couple hours each night, I sit down with I love coffee. So I sit down with a fresh cup of coffee and a carbonated water and go to town. I just released my third book, Amongst Thieves, which is a Western. We don't have a ton of time to talk about it, but it's a really cool Western story. If you like dark Gothic Westerns, that's another one for you. You can get that on Amazon, the Amongst Thieves. It's not available on my website yet, but you'll be able to find it on Amazon. But yeah, like, just because I can write so quickly, I'm able to produce those books. I'm trying to do two a year, so staying busy.
Wow. So Amongst Thieves, that's not a part of Henry. That's a whole nother.
Nope. That's a Western. So back in the 1880s. So I took a break from Henry for one book and dropped my pen in the Old West.
So what can you share 3 to 4 steps that you've taken, Harrison, that you found to be effective at getting the word out about your books?
Word of mouth is huge in the book community. I think that's probably the biggest. I think if you had $100,000 or $1 million marketing budget, you still wouldn't be able to beat word of mouth. Those book clubs and book communities are huge. I've been doing a lot of signings at bookstores, and I'll invite book clubs to come visit, and I'll give them, you know, if it's a book club, I'll give them free books, or I'll sign copies and give them the books at a discount just so I can get my books into the book reading community. Because the best thing that can happen to an author is for a group of avid book readers to absolutely love their book and recommend it to all their friends. So I think that word of mouth piece is huge. I've only just recently started doing more social media stuff. That's also pretty big. But I would say word of mouth. If you can get into some of those book clubs and get your books just in front of people, that's a really big deal.
Okay. And then also, where can off-the-shelf listeners get a copy of your books? And do you have any in audiobooks? Or do you have any in audiobook format?
I don't have any audiobooks right now, but I am looking into that. So we may get an audiobook for Henry's next book. Right now, the best place to get my books if you want them quick is Amazon. So if you go to Amazon on your app or your website and you search my name, Harrison Stockland, you can click on my author profile. I probably look younger than I sound, but you can click on that author profile, Harrison Stockland, and it'll show you all three of the books that are available for purchase, and you'll get it in like 2 days, which is pretty neat. They're also all on Kindle, so if you're a Kindle reader, you can get them there. And then November's Whisper and Watch It Burn are also available through my website, officialharrisonstockland.com. If you order through my website, I will sign the copy and send it to you. It'll just take a little bit longer.
Okay, you get an autographed copy. You can't beat that, especially if Harrison, if these books become movies or they ever take off. You'll be one of those with those early autographed copies. Do you have any upcoming speaking engagements? And if so, can you share a few of those with our off-the-shelf listeners?
I'll have a podcast on the 26th. I cannot remember the title of it. Off the top of my head. I think I have an idea, but I don't want to mess it up. So I'll have a podcast on the 26th, but I post all that stuff on my Facebook and my Instagram. So if you follow me, my Facebook and my Instagram, it's really easy. It's just my name, Harrison Stockland. Stockland is Stockeland. And I'd love to hear what you're thinking about the books. Drop comments on the posts. You can also write me an email at harrison@stocklandbooks.com, and I will get back to you as soon as I can. I love hearing feedback, criticism, all the good stuff like that. It helps me be a better author, and it helps me understand my readers as well.
Now, you just came out with Amongst Thieves. Last question, are you working on anything else right now? And just in less than a minute, can you give us insight into what you're working on, if you are working on something else?
Oh, of course. You know I'm working on my next one. The one I'm working on right now is Henry's next book, set in Minnesota. It's going to be a ton of fun. I think it's going to be the best. I know it's going to be the best book I've ever written, but I think it's going to be one of the best crime thrillers out there. And I don't say that lightly. It's very interesting, very complex, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, my goodness. We have had the pleasure of having Harrison. He said his name, Harrison Stockland, on here today, and I want to give you his website again. He is just pushing out these novels. Oh, my goodness, and this guy has a job on top of this. His website is officialharrisonstockland.com, OFFICIALHARRISONSTOCKELAND.com. He just came out Amongst Thieves. He's working on the next book with his main character, Henry, in it. There's November's Whisper. And his first novel, the first one, his debut, he published, Watch It Burn. Watch It Burn, November's Whisper, Amongst Thieves, and he's working on another one. So please get out and support Harrison Stoeckling. You can just hear him talk about his books, and he did a world of wealth of research on the topics that he's covering in his books. I think you'll really enjoy his stories. We want to thank Harrison for being here with us today. And to all of our off-the-shelf books listeners, as I always tell you, you are really, really incredible. You're awesome. You are amazing. Go out and create a fabulous day for yourself. And I'll see you back here next Saturday, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Harrison, I'll send you a link to the show when it finishes streaming. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having
me. Bye for now.
It was a great time. Bye.
Thank you. Bye for now.